Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I am Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
We've got a fantastic episode coming up with Guy Chambers. But firstly, how are you, Robin? How's your week been?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I'm doing good. I'm teaching Wuthering Heights at the moment, so I've kind of been cramming that in between reading about the Beatles, which has made a kind of quite confusing headspace.
Yeah, odd dreams.
Yeah, Wuthering Heights is really good, by the way. But anyway, aside from that reading, I've also started reading the Craig Brown book about the Beatles called 1, 2, 3, 4, which is an enormous tome, but it's very, very good.
Yeah, I can't wait. I've got it, but its heft has been putting me off.
Yeah, it's heft. But yeah, I've got there's a lovely bit here, which I think complements the Ian MacDonald quote we said in the first episode about the difference between John and Paul. The peculiar power of the Beatles' music, its magic and its beauty, lies in the intermingling of these opposites. So this is the opposite between John and Paul. Other groups were raucous or reflective, progressive or traditional, solemn or upbeat, folksy or sexy, or aggressive. But when you hear a Beatles album, you feel that all human life is there. As John saw it, when they were composing together, Paul provided a lightness and optimism, while I would always go for sadness, the discords, a certain bluesy edge. It was this finely balanced push-me-pull-you tension that made their greatest music so expressive, capable of being both universal and particular at one and the same time. Many of their songs have bright melodies but dark lyrics, or dark melodies but bright lyrics. The words of Help, Run for Your Life, Misery, and Maxwell's Silverhammer are all about... I can't believe he's defending Maxwell Silverhammer. We're all about depression and psychosis, but they are set to jaunty tunes. Deprived of this tug of war between the two competing partners, their solo songs often lack that dimension of otherness, with John falling back on self-pity and Paul giving in to whimsy.
Amazing. It's amazing how just people continue to write so beautifully about the relationship.
Yeah, exactly, and how rich it is. And I think he's so good at talking about the idea of bright melodies and dark melodies, because I think that is one thing about the Beatles that I love, is just how expressive the melodies are. It made me think of Fixing a Hole, which is one of my favourite Beatles songs, and the way the melody is, you know, I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in, stop my mind from wandering, and the melody kind of wanders off in this peculiar way. And that's very Paul.
So we've had some lovely correspondence in as well this week, and we're very touched and thrilled with all the lovely reviews that people leave on the Apple Podcasts page. You can get in touch with us via email if you email me at jack@homespunsounds.com, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact, and you can find us on all of our usual social media things at Personal Beatles, where we're on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all of that. But I got one particular lovely email that I was going to read out. This is from Katie Tucker. As she says, last year my GP lent me a device to monitor my high blood pressure. First go, it was typically far too high. I tried to go to a happy place to see if that would beneficially affect things. Some when and somewhere I had no worries. I immediately recalled my six-year-old self at home hearing Fool on the Hill and possibly my first recognition of what and who the Beatles were. I was learning to play an old Bakelite recorder at the time and my ears pricked up to the familiar tones, recorder, flutes, mellotron, all three. In the tune itself, I fell in love. I re-ran through the song and the memory of that in my head, a sort of guided meditation, if you like. Lo and behold, the very next reading on the blood pressure monitor had drastically decreased to within normal range. Well, there you go. The healing medicinal power of the Beatles. I've since Googled effects of music on heart rate, and of course there are many research papers exploring this, even one using Beatles songs, which is really interesting. I had a flick through it. It's a bit too technical for my layman knowledge, but we'll post the link to that because it is really interesting. So on with the show for this week. Today on the show, we've got another unbelievable guest, Mr. Guy Chambers, who is one of the UK's finest and most successful songwriters. He's had a string of UK number one hits, including a Christmas number one, and has written and worked with pretty much everyone in UK pop music royalty, but is probably best known for his work with Robbie Williams, writing tracks like Angels and Millennium and Let Me Entertain You in one of the most successful songwriting partnerships of recent times. And he's also a massive Beatles fan, so there was loads to talk about with him. He also went to school where John Lennon went to school, so there's some great chat about his relationship with John Lennon's old art teacher at Quarry Bank. And then, you know, the influence of the Beatles on his career, a little bit of working with Paul. What were your highlights of that one?
Yeah, I think it was a very good chat. It was very interesting. We talked a lot about the music industry now and the problems the music industry is having and kind of what hope we have for the future. And we talked a lot about the kind of production side of things, you know, Varispeed and all that. And mm-hmm. But I think what came through is just his passion. Like, he could have talked for hours, I think, about the Beatles. So it was just great to have a little slice of that, but also from someone who's worked with Paul McCartney and has recorded in Abbey Road and etc. So it was a great chat. And he also, his least favourite Beatles song is my favourite Beatles song, so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's amazing. So yeah, listen in, see which one that's going to be. You won't guess it. So now, please enjoy our fascinating conversation with Guy Chambers. So Robin and I are delighted to have with us this week musician, producer, writer, one of the most successful songwriters living in the UK at the moment, Guy Chambers. Thank you so much for joining us, Guy.
It's a pleasure, Jack. Nice to be here.
So we're going to ramble on about the Beatles for an hour or so. And you have a sort of easier segue than most because you went to Quarry Bank.
I did.
Which is where John and Wellen went to school. So I assume that that was quite, you know, were you a Beatles fan before that age? What was your first sort of memory of the Beatles?
My first memory of the Beatles was watching Hey Jude live on TV. So I think I would have been five. Yeah, I was five.
Oh, wow.
1968, they did a live performance of Hey Jude. And I remember... Paul McCartney looks particularly beautiful in that clip.
Yeah.
Is this the performance where they played Revolution as well in that clip?
I'm not sure I think it was the David Frost show.
Oh yeah.
They've got lots of hippies in the background all dancing and clapping.
Oh yeah,
there's a big orchestra behind them doing the na na nas. I just remember thinking, wow, what is this? And then of course my mum had the red compilation album and the blue compilation albums. So I used to play them to death, you know. And then she also had Revolver, which is my favourite Beatle album, if I had to pick one. And then many years later when I moved to Liverpool when I was 13, yeah, obviously by then I was a mega Beatle fan. And I lived very near John's house and Paul's house. I was sort of equidistant between both of them, and I was right by Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane and all these iconic places. And then when I was 16, I moved from one school to Quarry Bank for sixth form. And then I had the good fortune to have the same art teacher as John Lennon, a guy called Mr. Plent. And Mr. Plent and I got on really well, and I was rubbish at art, but I used to sort of hang out with his daughter, so we became really good friends. And Mr. Plent, after a while, said, "Do you want to come into the stock room? I've got something that might interest you." And I said, "Sure," and went into his back room, and there was John Lennon's desk.
Oh, wow.
Amazing.
With all the graffiti on it and strange drawings, and it had Little Richard written in it and Elvis Forever and things like that. It was pretty cool.
That's amazing.
Wow. And did you get some good stories about what he was like at school from Mr. Plent?
He just sort of said that he was a dreamer. He's always looking out the window. But he could be incredibly cutting and funny. Mm. But I think he thought he was really talented as an artist, that is.
Yeah. Some of his art is really great, especially the earlier stuff. There's some that stuff that sort of leaks out from his time at art school, and it's really impressive.
Yeah.
I haven't seen
There's a pub in Bristol, which is called the Cotton Porter Stores, which has a mural on the wall, which is apocryphally was drawn by the Beatles after they'd played at the Colston Hall, but they've left it up there.
Wow.
Which might be complete rubbish, but it's, you can see the... There is definitely... Lennon did have that a very nice style, a kind of naive style kind of thing.
Yeah. I've never heard that before. That's a new bit of Beatle paraphernalia.
So was there a sort of deification of him at the school? Because I remember reading that he got quite annoyed when the school would kind of use him as a sort of PR thing because he had a pretty tough time there apart from in his art classes.
No, there was not. And I also had the same headmaster, Mr. Popjoy. And when I tried to get any info out of Mr. Popjoy about John, he wasn't having it. He didn't want to talk about him. So I didn't get the sense that they were... I mean, the school is very sadly no longer called Quarry Bank. I don't know if you know that.
Really? No, I didn't know that.
The Liverpool Council, in their infinite wisdom, changed the name of the school. And it's now called something else. I think it's called Calderstones Comprehensive or something. I don't know what it's called. Which is just pathetic because it's like a... It's one of the most famous schools in the world, you know.
I mean, I suppose he got the airport, but...
Well, you know. Yeah, but John Lennon had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, that's true. So were you already a musician by the time that you started there?
Yeah, I was. I was playing in various bands, I was in a sort of indie band, playing, like, we played Dingwalls, for example, in London, and we played, we did a tour when I was a little bit older. And then I was also in a show band, a show band is where we play working men's clubs and play covers. And so, and I would play Beatles songs then, you know, like Day Tripper. And so I'd been learning Beatles songs since I was a child. I used to sit in front of the speakers with my guitar and play along and learn the bass. I used to spend hours learning the bass lines.
So this was always from the guitar?
Yeah, well, and the piano. I'd play along on the piano and learn Lady Madonna and that kind of thing. But I've always been very fascinated by the bass lines. I think Paul is such a... I know this has been said before, but his bass lines are so key to the way the songs work.
Yeah, I mean, you actually hum the bass lines. They're part of the kind of melodic of a, you know, in a song like... Something. you know, the bass line is such an integral part of that kind of the melodic world of that song.
Well, that song's it's pretty slow, and it's always difficult to produce a song that slow. And the bass actually fills all the holes, the gaps, and keeps it moving. And with a lesser bass player, that song could sound really ploddy.
Yeah,
and but he's. I'd have to say, if I had to pick one bass player in the world, he is my favourite bass player for sure. He's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's when you've got so many strings to your bow, it's one that's easily overlooked. But there's a lot of those songs that, you know, wouldn't be the same without it. Your dad, am I right in thinking, was a flautist in the Liverpool Philharmonic?
Yeah, he was originally in the London Philharmonic, and then. When I was 13, he moved from that orchestra to the Liverpool Philharmonic, and that's why I had 5 years in Liverpool,
right,
from 13 till I was 18.
And was he a Beatles fan?
He was. He I think he could. He liked things like the French horn solo in For No One.
Right. Okay.
And he knew that music. He knew a lot of the musicians who played on Beatles songs. You know, they were his friends. Yeah. So I had that nice connection there. And sometimes over the years, I've bumped into some of the musicians who've played on Beatle records. Derek Watkins comes to mind, who was an amazing trumpet player who played on Let Me Entertain You. And I think he definitely played on a few songs. I think he might... He didn't do the trumpet solo on Penny Lane, he did do... A few things.
Isn't the I remember reading the trumpet solo, or is it a cornet? Is actually Penny Lane's actually a bit sped up, isn't it? So it's actually.
I thought it was a piccolo trumpet.
Yeah, okay. It is.
But I could be wrong.
I'm out of Beatles Club.
I don't think it's a cornet. I don't think there's any cornet solo on a Beatles record. But okay. I could be wrong.
But so a lot of those songs were, I think I remember reading about the guy who played that on Penny Lane always said he could play along to the record, but it's been sped up in such a way that makes it hard to play along to.
Yeah, Barry Speed was a huge thing for the Beatles. You know, they would speed up a lot of things, and they would sometimes slow things down, like Rain, for example, is heavily slowed down.
Strawberry Fields is another one, isn't it?
Yeah, heavily sped up. If you listen to the demo of that on Anthology, it's pretty incredible how much slower it is. But that's drugs for you. I mean, by the time they were making Pepper, they were pretty stoned or on acid. So it's hard to get tempo right.
Rubber Soul's definitely the kind of marijuana record, and then things get slightly heavier as they're going onwards in 66 and 67.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny drugs, isn't it? Because people seem so anti them in some ways, but they were very helpful to the Beatles.
Yeah. Mm. Well, helpful in that period and then not so helpful later on, I think.
Well, you're talking about Let It Be period.
Well, yeah, I think heroin isn't quite as sort of creatively friendly.
Well, you say that, but John's first solo album is my favourite. The Plastic Ono Band.
Oh, and
he was recovering from heroin.
Yeah.
Heroin had a part in that record, but I'd never want to say that was a good thing, a good option for someone to go down.
Hi, it's Robin here. Just want to reiterate that heroin is bad.
So is something like Vary Speed, is that something that you've ever toyed with in the studio?
Oh, yeah, no, I've quite a few Robbie records are Vary Speed.
Right.
I don't think we ever went slower, but we definitely would often tweak the songs when they went to mastering.
Right, okay.
Which is mastering is when you finish, when the record's mixed, you then go to an expert who makes all the songs on a record work with one another, because sometimes record songs are different volume and some songs are too bassy, some songs are too bright, and a good mastering engineer will balance that all out. And sometimes when we're in mastering, we'd hear songs against one another and you think, oh, that song feels a bit slow now.
And so when you were Vary Speeding then, was that all analog stuff you were doing, or were you kind of digitally tinkering to speed things up?
Early days it would have been analog with tape, and then it started going digital in the early 2000s. Sadly, I'm a big analog fan, but
Speaking of which, I've seen that you've got a pretty impressive desk in your studio in West London.
I do.
Is that an Abbey Road desk? That it's an EMI desk, isn't it? But was it ever used to record any Beatles stuff?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure. It was in Studio 3 for a while, in the early 70s. So I think solo Beatles might have used it, but not as a band.
Okay.
But that's, you know, it's a very beautiful, and if anybody listening to this wants to see it, if they go to maloco.com and put in Sleeper Studios, you'll be able to look at it. There's pictures of it in there, and it's a very beautiful thing, because you didn't know it was made out of bomber parts from German bomber parts. It was a German company that called Red, R-E-D-D, and they reuse German bomber parts to make those desks, and that's why they got the sliding faders, just like in an aircraft.
Ah, right, because it does look like, a cockpit to a certain extent.
Yeah, and that's the only reason they had that volume thing with the sliding faders. There was no other reason.
What is it about the quality of that piece of equipment that gives you
It's very edge? Neutral. Very neutral. So what you get... But then having said that, it is neutral, but then the EQ is very unique. You know, the top, the treble, the bass... And the compressors are particularly fierce. You know, they're sort of prehistoric, but sometimes they're just what you... You know that piano sound, that the Beatle piano sound is very distinctive. And it's a combination of... I mean, I've spent years trying to get that sound in my studio. I've got it now. It took me a long time. Yeah. But it's the right microphone. It's the right... Putting the mic through the right mic pre... And then also the compressor is absolutely key. And
yeah,
the compressor they used in the desk is very, very distinctive and very fierce. And it's but if you put it on, if you have the right combination, it's instant Beatles, which I yeah. like.
You mentioned elsewhere about how much you liked Freddie Mercury's piano playing as well.
Oh, that I love Freddie Mercury's piano playing. Well, I was lucky enough to hear when we... I did a version of We Are the Champions with Rob, and I had to learn the piano part. And I was given the piano part on its own track, so I could hear it just on its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the piano part is absolutely incredible.
There's just so much attack in the way he plays.
Yeah, he was very rhythmic. Mm. But he had to be, because you understand the band is only a three-piece band. It's just bass, drums, guitar and piano. It's very, very simple. Mm. You have to do a lot to make that sound that they created, just as the Beatles had to as well. You know, they didn't really have additional instrumentalists until Billy Preston came along right at the end.
Yeah. But I mean, there'd been a lot of double tracking of piano,
. Well, that's one of their tricks, isn't it? They would they'd have a piano and then they would double it with their jangle piano, as the tack piano that they had. But the sound of Penny Lane is three different pianos.
Yeah, it's got that slight chorusy
playing
sound
the same thing. Yeah, it would be chorusy because they wouldn't all be exactly in tune.
Yeah,
and it's a particularly great sound, the piano sound on Penny Lane.
Mm. Mm. Have you been to Abbey Road and messed around on all of those pianos that are still there?
I have quite a few times over the years. they lost a lot. I mean, Paul's got quite a lot of the stuff. I've been to Paul's studio as well in Sussex, and I saw a lot of the original Beatles stuff. He's got the original lights that they had, the neon lights that were brought in to make it more psychedelic in 1967, I think. They got fed up of the very sort of municipal like lighting that they had in there.
Yeah.
But they have still got the so-called Mrs. Mills piano, which was the honky-tonk piano. They still got that at Abbey Road. They've still got the original Steinway that they played, and they've got the original organ, well, one of the original organs. But they got the Celeste that they used. They got a few things, but they lost a lot as well, sadly. But you know, the trouble with Abbey Road, there's no storage.
Right,
there's hardly any storage space. So that's why my desk went. They didn't have any room to store it, so they let one of the engineers take it. I think for free. He put it in his garage for years, and then he heard about me wanting one and hit me up and said, well, it's X amount, and it was a shocking amount of money at the time.
Wow.
But because I'm such a Beetlehead, I got it, and it was actually a good investment long term.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
I love that. The history of the Beatles is the history of storage solutions.
Well, part of it, yeah.
Been lucky enough to go down to Paul's studio and stuff. Have you ever worked with him, or did you jam with him when you're down there?
No, I did a charity record called He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, for Hillsborough.
Oh, yeah.
I produced that a few years ago, and Paul sang on that, and also he played a guitar solo, and I had the rather extraordinary experience of singing him a melody, because he initially played a guitar solo, and I said, that's great, Paul, but I've got this other idea. Do you mind if I sing you the melody and you play my melody? And he went, sure. And
well, that's a hell of a moment.
he learnt the part and he played it. And it was, I thought, wow, I'm singing, I'm actually producing Paul McCartney. I had a lovely day in his studio, and he showed me his... the original Bolex, I think it's, I forget the name of the tape recorder, which he did the Seagulls, recorded the Seagulls on for Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah.
He's got that original.
Isn't that supposed to be his laughing played backwards or something? Or is it actually a seagull?
He said it was seagulls.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's a very evocative sound, the Seagulls, isn't it? I mean, do you know the band Boards of Canada?
Electronic.
Yeah. There's a great song of theirs they did for a Peel session, which has got a seagull sample.
Okay.
And there's something so, I mean, possibly because it's the Beatles, but there's something so kind of weirdly psychedelic and evocative about that sound.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's got that sort of peculiar mix of sort of nostalgia for something you don't remember yourself, which is what Boards of Canada do very, very well.
Yeah.
But it's possibly, I mean, Boards of Canada are big Beatles fans as well, so it's possibly a nod to them.
It's slightly crazy, the sound, isn't it? It sounds a bit like somebody losing their mind.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
And I think the Beatles were attracted to that, you know, that they weren't scared of insanity, you know, and you can hear that in tracks like Tomorrow Never Knows and Revolution Number 9, of course, which is, you know, there aren't many bands that have done an avant-garde art piece as one, you know, but actually dared to put it out.
Well, there's a great line in Revolution in the Head where Ian MacDonald says that Revolution Number 9 is the sort of the most widely distributed piece of avant-garde music in the world, which is, you know, for lots of people don't like that song for various reasons, but that's a great kind of fact, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be. It shows you that music, it can literally be anything, as did John Cage, of course. And John Cage is 4:33, which is for piano, and it's just silence. Yeah. I think the Beatles were influenced. I know, of course, Paul was very much into that whole avant-garde world. And But it was a statement of intent, wasn't it? It was sort of saying they weren't scared of anything, which I think was incredible. I mean, I found it quite scary as a child, remember?
Yeah, me and my brother used to quote bits from it, and, you know, it's very creepy.
It is creepy. Yeah. But it kind of...
Take this, brother. May it serve you well.
That's right, yeah. But it sort of reflects... I always think about the Paris riots and the riots that were going on in America, the race riots. And I think it reflects, you know, Vietnam, of course. I think it reflects the way the world was going darker in 68 after the sort of...
Yeah.
The ecstasy of Summer of Love, and then the dream started sort of turning into a nightmare as the 60s, just as it is now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So one question that we ask everyone on the podcast is, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I don't think any of the singles are overrated. There's that song Long Long Long. Is it called that? Long 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 Long? The song White Album. That's a very poor song.
Really? That is Robin's genuinely favorite, my favourite Beatles song.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I've never met someone. Okay, well, good for you. Well, there you go.
Because I just think it's so beautiful. The atmosphere of it is so kind of, I don't know, it's unlike any other Beatles song, definitely.
It is.
It's such a quiet song, and it's got such dynamic range. I think I said on one podcast we did, it's almost like a talk later period kind of Mark Hollis thing, where it's this incredible dynamic range. But by poured, what do you mean poured? It's interesting, like melodically.
Just not memorable. Not memorable. Yeah. I just find it a bit of a dirge.
Right, yeah.
But that's one of the very few Beatles songs that I don't like. They're not many. There's another one on White Album. I don't really like Why Don't We Do It in the Road. Okay. I find that a bit... The catalogue is so extraordinary.
Yeah.
It seems churlish to be critical of it, to be honest.
My controversial Beatles opinion, and I think George Martin had the same feeling, was that the White Album really should have been one record, and the dirge could have been chucked. But I suppose it's such a fascinating historical kind of artifact. But at the same time, when I stick on Abbey Road, I don't sit through Revolution Number 9 every single time.
No.
With White Album, there's stuff like Wild Honey Pie and, you know, I think that's fairly... And Piggies and things like that. But I think you need I think we've mentioned this before, but I love the White Album because it's sort of like this big haunted house that you're kind of finding all these unexpected corners in. And so I think you need all those strange elements in it somehow. But
Yeah, no, and it reflects their maturity. Mm-hmm. And it reflects their experience in Ricky Kesh very much.
Definitely.
And discovering meditation. I've been lucky enough also to be in Paul's house in St. John's Wood. And I went into the garden and I've been inside the meditation dome that he built.
Oh, wow.
Did you know that they used to meditate together inside this dome?
Okay, yeah.
And, they used to go for breaks they'd walk from Abbey Road. It's a 10-minute walk from Abbey Road to Paul's house. And then they would sit in that dome, presumably get stoned, and meditate. And I think that I've always been fascinated by that. And Paul said he still meditates now. Mm. That sort of group energy that they had, you can really feel that on the White Album, is all the different, well, their different personalities really become what, because part with Pepper was very much Paul's vision, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I think with White Album, you can see them breaking up as well. You can feel the tension in the band, but it's also fascinating as well. And
yeah, definitely. I think the only song that was co-written was Birthday, wasn't it? Which was the Lennon McCartney one. Every other song is by an individual in that album.
Yeah,
and
I don't even think Birthday was...
Yeah. It's not amazing. It's got a nice Led Zepp style break in it, though, I think.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, no, I think it's a great... Well, they were trying to compete with Jimi Hendrix by that point. Yeah.
It's interesting, just to go back a bit, because we were talking about the experimentalism, kind of Paul's interest in the avant-garde and things, and then also marrying that with pop. I mean, how do you feel that kind of relationship has had an effect in your career? Because as writing pop songs, but also having an experimental kind of quality to experimental interests.
I know it definitely has had an effect. Although I wouldn't like to say I'm a experimental producer or anything. I think I'm pretty mainstream in my taste. But then Rob and I have done quite a lot of concept songs, like Millennium, Party Like a Russian. And I think we're not scared of doing songs that are quite bold statements. And we're also, I think another thing I learned from the Beatles was not to be scared of changing the style quite radically from different albums, and you know, because they were very good at moving around stylistically. I really believe that's a good thing for an art. I mean, I obviously get that from David Bowie as well, but I'd like to think with Rob, if you look at his albums, the ones I've been involved with, they're all quite different. You know, they there is a progression going on there. Or, well, I don't know if the word progression is right, because I think the first album is probably my favourite, but there's a lot of variety in the work we've done together, which I'm proud of.
I always liked Lazy Days on the first album.
Lazy Days. Well, yeah. Lazy Days used to be a Lemon Trees song.
Right.
Yeah, right.
I was in a band called the Lemon Trees, and yeah, that was actually had already been written and recorded and everything. And but he said, "Oh, I really like. Can I sing that song?" And I said, "Yes." And then he co-wrote. He sort of changed some of the lyrics and changed the structure of it as well. But yeah, thank you. I like that song too.
Because I remember when that album came out, Life Through a Lens, and there was this all this talk about Robbie Williams and kind of, I suppose, the credibility question and. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can someone from a boy band make a sort of artistically serious album, I suppose? And then you hear those songs, you know, that is actually good. You know, like, there's that, you know, you're surprised. It's like, this stuff is good. You know, it's good quality songwriting.
Is Robbie a Beatles fan? Is he...
He is. He is. He's nowhere near my level of... you know, I'm like a disciple. Mm. He is a fan, but... He's more into hip-hop, house music, indie music like the Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, that kind of thing. I guess obviously he's a lot younger than I am. He's only 46 now, but it's more my generation, I think, that have like complete indoctrination by the band, if you like, whatever better word.
And you've talked elsewhere about how for certain songs it was almost like they were deliberate little nods to the Beatles, like one song which was a tribute to Taxman.
We did a song called Heaven From Here
right.
That's on the second album, okay. And that is very much inspired by Norwegian Wood.
Oh, okay. Oh,
it's right. Similar in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I similar... It's not the same though. I mean, we were careful, but the feel of it, and I tried to get a flute solo on it, just like Norwegian Wood, and Rob didn't allow it, which actually was my dad playing.
Oh, really? That
but, would be nice. Which is a bit sad for me, but Rob thought it. I mean, he thought it was too close to Norwegian Wood, so
right.
He probably made the right call actually.
Was it Ego A Go Go, one of yours that's got a Beatles?
Okay, that is a bit Taxman in some ways. Ego's quite Beatley, but it's also very much influenced by Sammy Davis Jr. and that sort of Vegas-y thing that I really love and Rob really loves, sort of late 60s Vegas, Tom Jones, Elvis, Sammy Davis Jr. We love that big... kind of big band sound.
Well, that kind of Taxman bass line has got that jazzy feel.
Yeah.
You know, if you make it a bit more swingy, then it kind of goes into that sort of more jazzy kind of thing.
No, there's definitely bass lines on our records that are very much influenced by Paul big time. Yeah, as I said, I do like bass lines that are melodic, that you can sing and the song like Strong, for example... That has a very, very Beatley bass line in it. If you listen, focus on the bass for a minute. They've been a bit of constant. They're constantly with you. Well, with me as a songwriter, they're always a presence in. You just can't deny it.
I've been teaching guitar since lockdown started and sort of doing some online tutoring, and Norwegian Wood's a song we like to work on. And there's that thing when you work out a song and you're playing them the bridge and, you know, it goes into the D minor and then it goes to the G, and then it's that kind of A that brings you back to D, and they always go, oh, wow, that's so nice, you know. And that's isn't that such a lovely moment of working out Beatles songs and kind of hearing that magic, I think. That's something that really unlocks them for you.
Well, I always say to aspiring songwriters that if they whoever they're really into, whatever artist it is, they should learn their songs. Mm. And learn to actually play them, because that's the way you unlock the secrets. It's actually playing the chords and singing along to the melodies. And that's what I did with the Beatles. I also did it with Queen a lot. and Zeppelin, but mainly with the Beatles. And I can sit down at the piano and pretty much play any song, I think, pretty much.
What was your instrument of choice then when you were growing up? What did you? You were at Guildhall, I know, but did you focus on one instrument?
Guildhall, I did piano and composition, but that'd be the first instrument. When I was five, I had piano lessons.
Oh right.
And then when I was about nine, I got into the guitar, and had lessons when I was in Liverpool, and learned all those jazzy chords that I couldn't figure out on my own.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have a period where you sort of lost the Beatles and then came back to them when you were experimenting with other types of music, or is it a constant?
No, it's definitely not constant. I have periods when, through saturation, I can't listen to them at all. I overdid it when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I have to have quite long, like, detoxes, yeah, if you like, from them. And then I'll have... Then, like, for example, I bought the remix of Pepper, which I think is absolutely...
Incredible.
It's so much better than the original version.
Well, that's the great thing about these remasters and remixes, that you're kind of... Pepper is just so familiar to everyone. But then I was listening to that and it's like a new album or something. You're hearing so much more in it. You know, for instance, Fixing a Hole is like such a great song, which I hadn't really...
Yeah, well, because the drums are louder.
Yeah.
And they sound... They just sound so much better, the drums.
Mm.
And that really pushes the song along in it. No, I mean, me and my son, because my son's now become... He's 17 and we sit down... We do quite an old-fashioned thing. We were sitting down in front of the speakers. I've got a really nice sound system here in Sussex, and we sit down and listen to a whole record, you know, and really get into it. But at the moment I'm having a bit of a detox, but I'm waiting, like I'm sure every Beatle fan, for the Let It Be film.
Yeah.
Mm,
When that comes, that's going to be a huge... I just hope we can go into a cinema hope I can go to the premiere. That's
yeah, that would be amazing. And I hope it's not too upsetting as well, because I find it quite hard to watch those late Beatle footage when they're obviously at each other's throats the whole time.
Have you seen the original film or not?
I have seen it, sort of bits of it on YouTube in a sort of unofficial, illicit way.
Right, because they took it off screen in 1986, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm old enough to remember seeing it on TV.
Yeah.
They used to play it on TV quite regularly.
There's quite a lot of clips from it in Anthology, isn't there? They had quite a few clips from it.
No, it is a really heavy film. It's actually quite hard to get through, but apparently the new version is not as heavy as the original. It has much more of them enjoying themselves and laughing and telling jokes, and it's much more fun, apparently. But it's still time travel, isn't it? It's wonderful to see the 60s come to life in colour like that, and you know, they were such beautiful human beings. It's quite amazing just seeing them being creative, and you still see the bonds between them. Obviously, it's that old thing of that person you love the most is the one you're going to hurt the most, and you can see that with George and Paul in their relationship, and John and Paul, and Ringo looking bored out of his mind.
Yeah.
But it's also got the joy of the clothes and the fact that they built that crazy studio at Apple downstairs, which had a real fireplace. And, you know, these funny little things that, because obviously there is a lot of footage from Abbey Road, but there isn't much footage from them at that time as much as other times.
Mm.
And it's amazing how uncomfortable they look when they're filming in the Twickenham film studio.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they had to get there early, you know, famously, and they all. I think Paul was fine getting up early, but the other three just weren't interested.
Is this the famous George quote? I'll play what you want me to play. I'll play. Yeah.
Well, in any band, there's always someone who's in charge. And what was very unusual with that band was that you had sort of two leaders in one band. You had John and Paul, both equally as strong. And that at the beginning was an incredible strength, but as it went on, and when Brian Epstein died, John started losing interest in the Beatles, I think, on some levels. Paul had to take over as the driving force, and that create, obviously, you really see it in that film, the tension that creates. He's always pushing them on to do stuff, whereas you can sort of see them losing interest.
Yeah, that's amazing, though, isn't it, to think that you can definitely sense that, as you say, that John losing interest in the as the 60s progressed, but you're still able to produce such incredible things in such a short space of time. I mean, just go back to the White Album again, you know, so the songs are so finished. And he must have, they must have been written so quickly, you know, something like Sexy Sadie. Or...
Yeah, plenty. You've got to remember that in Ricky Kesh, they were there for 3 months.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
And there was no distractions back there. I mean, this is something people, younger people forget. You know, there was no internet. There was people used the phone once a week.
Yeah.
They didn't have any TV there. I think they might have had a... I think they had tape recorders.
Right, yeah, because there are some demos, aren't there?
Yeah.
But they, which are beautiful, aren't they? They're so beautiful, those demos. Mm. But there was no distractions. They had all day to write songs. Yeah. So they would, I think sometimes they'd write 3 in a day.
Cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better. So cry, baby, cry. The king was in the garden picking flowers for a friend who came to play. The queen was in the playroom painting pictures for the children's holiday. Cry, baby, cry.
It is an issue that because the arts aren't valued, if you're a young artist, your kind of default thing is that the work I'm producing has no value. And that kind of makes you it harder to progress and be good at it in a way. No, I mean, not be good at it, but I mean, it's you're demoralized from the start, you know.
No, it's, you know, we had a problem before lockdown. Like one of the big problems for young artists is how much music there's already out there. You know, with Spotify, I think I'm right in saying there's 30,000 on average new songs a week.
Wow.
Right.
Insane.
So it's very difficult to get your songs noticed.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. And that's kind of heartbreaking in itself. I think one of the things... Well, I felt this with Rob, that there's nothing much more inspiring for a writer than knowing you have an audience and they are waiting for your next piece.
Yeah.
And obviously the Beatles famously had that from the word, you know, from the... They had this incredible audience. Millions and millions of people throughout the world were literally waiting, counting down the days for their next release.
Yeah.
And they knew that, and obviously that was a lot of pressure, especially around sort of 65, 66, when it was constantly, they're constantly being pestered by EMI for another single. But that is also incredibly good, I think, for artists to have deadlines, to have a ready-made audience, and obviously they were earning... You know, they were playing massive gigs and earning lots of money and buying flashy cars and glamorous girlfriends and all the rest of it.
Rubber Soul, they had 2 weeks to do it because it was going to be, they wanted it ready for the Christmas market.
Well, there you go. 65. I mean, it's insane. The pressure was just...
Yeah.
But I don't think they were so young and they had this just unbelievable energy that...
Yeah.
You can hear it in the records now. That's partly why they're dating really well, I think, is that their energy is just extraordinary between the four of them.
I think it's for people of our generation, it's hard to know just how exciting it would be to hear a new Beatles album come out. And it must be unbelievable. I mean, I was reading about the Sgt. Pepper the day that that came out and the review in the Times that after about two plays said it was the most important cultural artefact of the 20th century.
Well, it is.
Yeah, I mean, fair play to them. I think they also went round to Mama Cass's house in the King's Road and played it out the window on her speakers like 3 weeks before it came out.
Wow.
Which, again, I think you might be in a little bit of trouble with your label if you did that these days.
Well, yes, only if you're a big artist.
Yeah.
You know, as I say, for a lot of young artists, I think a lot of musicians, artists, performers, whatever, we're all feeling very like we are members of staff that aren't wanted anymore. Mm. And all we've got left is a begging bowl.
Yeah, asking for tips on Spotify is particularly demeaning, I think.
Well, that's what it's come down to. Yeah. I try to stay positive, but...
One thing that's helped me in terms of this is I've recently started working for Pirate Studios, the rehearsal rooms, and they've just reopened after lockdown 2 weeks ago. And I'm just working at the one in Greenwich, and they're absolutely... it's very much a London thing, but the incredible range of music that young people are making is quite inspiring, because you hear grime, R&B, hip-hop, indie, gospel, jazz. Just incredible. You hear this amazing jazz drummer practicing in a room, and he comes out and he looks like he's about 12, you know. And so kids are still very energized by music and making music.
Oh, yeah.
Whether they'll make livings and buy fancy cars from the proceeds, I'm not sure.
Well, my son is 17, and he's a really talented musician. He's a brilliant drummer. He's a brilliant piano player. But he wants to be a lawyer. he doesn't think there's any way he's going to earn a living.
Yeah. Mm. It's a shit business.
Well, it's full of horrible people, unfortunately. Mm. It's one of the... Well, you know, as the Beatles found with Alan Klein.
Yeah. Beginning of the end. Just wanted to ask you about, because obviously the Beatles' massive influence on you as a songwriter, but how much influence did George Martin have on you when you're in with your producer hat on?
Huge. I mean, George is... And I was lucky to meet him a couple of times as well. And he was... But he used to have this studio in Oxford's Circus called Air. Mm. It was high up on at the top floor overlooking Oxford Circus. It was an extraordinary place. I was working with Aztec Camera at the time. And I met George then. That would have been about 1987, maybe 86, then. But and he was very charismatic. Anyway, I mean, yeah, no, obviously I've studied his production very carefully, and the use of orchestration, of course, for me is a huge thing. You know, using instruments that, you know, like the solo on For No One, the French horn solo, or the piccolo solo in Penny Lane, or obviously the string octet arrangement on Eleanor Rigby, which has got to be the best arrangement of a pop song ever. It's the most incredible arrangement. It's very inspiring, and I see it, to me, it's like that's like the top level of what you're trying to get to. I wouldn't be arrogant enough to say I've ever got to that level, but that's where I'm trying to get to, and try to get to with Robbie Records and various other people's records. I'm always, not that I'm necessarily stylistically wanting to be in that same world, but just the use of colour and instrumentation, and also the daring in his, he was a very bold producer as well. I mean, I think that he was very brave, but obviously he was very much pushed by pioneers, which is what they were. They were total pioneers.
Yeah. I always think with George Martin, I mean, we used to have that record, the All Aboard record. There's a lot of George Martin produced.
I don't
stuff
know that.
It's the kind of the lots of children's stuff. And
well, he right, when what year is
this
that?
This is pre, so it's kind of, it would have been before the Beatles when he, you know, the stuff he was producing before then was kind of.
Well, I know the Goons show, but and he also produced a jazz band, didn't he? What were they called? The Pasadena? No, they weren't called that. Weren't they called the Pasadena Roof Orchestra? Didn't he produce them?
Yeah, possibly. I think, didn't he do some stuff with Humphrey Littleton as well?
Humphrey Littleton, yeah. He did a lot of jazz.
A lot of Beatles stuff.
I might have to quickly Google this.
But I don't know about All Aboard. That sounds... Is it a good record?
I mean, it's a kind of mixed bag. It's it's lots of different children's songs. It had, like, The Laughing Policeman on it and things like this.
Oh, yeah, well, that was a huge... That was a huge song for me growing up. That Ed Stewart used to play it on Radio 1.
And Right Said Fred by Bernard Cribbins was on it.
Another big record.
Goodness Gracious Me and... My Boomerang Won't Come Back, all these kinds of things. I always thought that George Martin had something to do with those songs, but I might be wrong. Ernie, the Fastest Milkman in the West by Benny Hill as well was on there.
Did he produce that?
Well, I always assumed he had, but I might be utterly wrong in my assumption.
I bought that record.
Well, there we go.
Hi, Robin here. Just want to reiterate that the album All Aboard does indeed feature a song that was produced by George Martin. In fact, maybe a couple of songs, but definitely Right Said Fred by Bernard Cribbins was produced by George Martin. Just wanted to clear that up.
George Martin just seems like yet another insanely serendipitous element of the sort of Beatles concoction that just seems far too good to be true.
This is a kind of question we're asking... guests, did the Beatles actually exist, or are they too good to be true?
A bit like the moon landing, you mean?
Yeah. A kind of sense of, the story is so good that it makes you question reality, you know?
I mean, I do think they're like, their iconic status now has made them almost supernatural. I know what you mean, and there's no band to compare them with, and they're... since really even though obviously various bands have tried to emulate them, in like Oasis, of course. That's the only thing I think about a lot, is who's going to be, will we ever have another band culturally that has that gravitas and changes the world to that extent. And I'd like there to be another band that does it, but
hard to imagine now, really.
But it is part of that kind of post-war culture. And then there's a really lovely bit at the end of... You mentioned Oasis at the end of the Supersonic film, where Noel Gallagher makes this very sort of elegiac point that you couldn't really have an event like that now, where a band at that point in time, like Oasis in the mid-90s, meant so much to so many people. Because after that, the internet came along and everything became so much more dispersed and things, and... So there's a sense of that with the Beatles as well, is that they were such a unifying band that spoke so much of their time as well, that, you know, it's hard to imagine something similar happening now.
Well, I think I agree, but then I would say if Beyonce did a massive gig in this country, it would have a similar... She'd be able to do a gig as big as that.
Yeah,
And she's like a... I would say she's like... She's channeling some of the Beatles' spirit. I mean, obviously not musically, but she's someone who's extremely artistic.
Yeah.
And daring.
Yeah. My Homecoming was just amazing, wasn't it? That whole Coachella performance.
Yeah.
Was just incredible.
I always think she's the closest we have to the Beatles. You know, she's obviously incredibly mainstream. Her and Rihanna are the biggest R&B stars in the world, but she's got this radical element to her that is very Beatles.
So that was Guy Chambers. Fascinating stuff. Massive thanks for him for taking out the time to do it. It's a really lovely, sort of humble, generous man. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was great. He was so eloquent, and I loved listening to him talk. You got the sense that he was kind of... There were so many amazing stories. He was being quite modest about, you know.
Yeah, he's probably held a few back.
But it was great. Very generous with his time. And, very humble and just passionate and wanted to talk about them. So it was great.
So thank you so much for making it this far. You're always our favourite people when you get to this stage. Next week, we've got another amazing guest. I should probably stop saying we've got amazing guests every week because the inference is that one day I'll be like, today we've got a bit of a duff guest.
A shit guest.
Which we're obviously never going to have shit guests. But we do have an amazing guest. The stand-up comedian, writer and actor, Mae Martin, who was absolutely fantastic. And that's really interesting. She is a massive Beatles nut to the extent that she has a Beatles song tattooed on her.
Not an entire song, just the title. But yeah.
Just the title, yeah. Not the whole lyrics. Yeah, so we talked to her about her sitcom Feel Good, about her relationship with the Beatles. There's loads of stuff.
Yeah, which friend would be which Beatle?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so that's something to look forward to. Yeah. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week and continue to sort of send in your correspondence and stuff to jack@homespunsounds.com. And yeah, follow us on Instagram if you like the show. Please do give us a rating. It's really helpful if you're an Apple Podcast listener. And tell your friends. See you next week, Robin.
Yeah, see you next week.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.